From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
They went into the prison. Very, very tough orders were given. We're going to use coercion if we have to, and we're also going to use sexual blackmail. We're going to get these Ba'athist Sunnis. Rumsfeld was calling them by that time last fall the dead-enders.
Today we speak with Seymour Hersh, who's reporting the prison abuse scandal in Iraq is the result of a top-secret black operations program okayed by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Then we take a look at Halliburton. People are descending on Houston from around the country to protest Halliburton's annual shareholders meeting. We'll speak with author Dan Briotti, who wrote The Halliburton Agenda.
Halliburton's contracts in Iraq are approaching $9 billion, and some of that is my money, and I'm not happy about the way it's being spent.
Today, making a killing off the killing. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The head of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council was killed this morning in a massive car bomb explosion near the U.S. occupation headquarters in Baghdad. The Washington Post report 10 others died in the blast. Izzedine Salim became the second member of the Governing Council to have been killed over the past year. Salim was a Shiite leader as well as a writer, philosopher and political activist. The attack comes 6 weeks before the U.S. is scheduled to hand over limited sovereignty to a still-to-be-determined form of an Iraqi government on June 30th. News reports say it's unclear if the bombing was a targeted assassination. Salim was in a car waiting to enter the heavily fortified green zone when the bomb exploded. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker magazine is reporting the prison abuse scandal in Iraq is the result of a top-secret black operations program okayed by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld that called for the use of physical coercion and sexual humiliation during the interrogation of high-value suspects in the war on terror. Hersh reports the secret program began with al-Qaeda operatives but was expanded in Iraq last year as the resistance against the U.S. occupation increased. We'll be speaking to Seymour Hersh in just a few minutes. Newsweek is reporting President Bush had decided by January 2002 that the Geneva Conventions would not apply to members of the Taliban or al-Qaeda. Newsweek obtained a memo to the president from White House legal counsel Alberto Gonzalez that read, quote, "As you have said, the war against terrorism is a new kind of war. The nature of the new war places a high premium on other factors, such as the ability to quickly obtain information from captured terrorists and their sponsors in order to avoid further atrocities against American civilians. In my judgment, this new paradigm renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions." And South Korea's foreign ministry has announced the U.S. is planning to move 4,000 U.S. troops now stationed in South Korea to Iraq for combat duty. Thousands of Palestinians are fleeing the Rafah refugee camp today in southern Gaza, fearing a massive Israeli strike and more home demolitions. Israel has announced plans to cut off Rafah, which sits on the Egyptian border, from the rest of Gaza and demolish hundreds of more Palestinian homes. On Friday, the United Nations reported 88 homes in Rafah were leveled, leaving more than 1,000 Palestinians homeless. 2,200 Palestinians have now been left homeless this month alone in Gaza. The demolition stopped for a brief time this weekend as the Israeli Supreme Court heard an appeal from Palestinians. But the court ruled the army could legally go ahead with the demolitions, which have widely been criticized by the international community. Amnesty International is expected to release a report later this week charging that the house demolitions are a form of international war crime. And on Saturday, Secretary of State General Colin Powell said, quote, "We oppose the destruction of homes. We don't think it is productive." On Saturday, up to 150,000 Israelis rallied in Rabin Square in Tel Aviv, calling for Israel to pull out of Gaza. It was the largest peace protest since the 1980s during Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Polls now show at least 70% of Israelis favor pulling settlements out of Gaza, but so far Ariel Sharon's Likud party has blocked his plans for a pullout. Also over the weekend, Israel carried out nightly bombing raids on Gaza City as it attempted to assassinate the top officials of Islamic Jihad. Israeli warships also attacked offices connected to Hamas and Yasser Arafat's Fatah faction. 50 years ago today, the Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education, the doctrine separate but equal has no place in the U.S. public schools. The ruling would help spark the civil rights movement and was supposed to lead to the end of government-sanctioned segregation in the country. Many researchers say the ruling was not fully lived up to its promise. The Harvard Civil Rights Project has found school integration, which peaked in 1988, is now at the same level it was in 1969. A recent report of theirs concluded, "We're celebrating a victory over segregation at a time when schools across the nation are becoming increasingly segregated." According to the Harvard Civil Rights Project, 1 in 8 Southern African American students attend a school that is 99% black. About a third attend schools that are at least 90% minority. In the Northeast, more than half of African Americans attend such schools. Hundreds of gay and lesbian couples are beginning to file for marriage licenses today across Massachusetts, which has become the first state in the union to recognize same-sex marriages. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an 11th-hour effort by conservative and religious groups to block the state from giving out marriage licenses. In Cambridge, City Hall opened its doors just after midnight this morning as 250 couples waited in line to apply for licenses. Susan Shepherd and her partner Marsha Hams were the first to apply. Outside City Hall, 10,000 supporters gathered to mark the historic event. In November, the state Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of gay marriage. This came after 7 same-sex couples sued the state for the right to marry. We go now to speak with one of the couples who filed suit in 2001. Right now, they are waiting in line on the steps of City Hall in Northampton to apply for a marriage license. Gina Smith and Heidi Norton are with us. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Begin with Gina Smith. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'm sorry, this is Heidi Norton.
Oh, hi, Heidi. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thank you.
Can you tell us what the scene is at Northampton?
Well, we are just at this very moment turning the corner and arriving in front of the City Hall, the municipal building, and I see it looks like well over 100 people standing outside. Everybody's got big smiles on their faces, and people are holding flowers, and it looks like a huge party. Balloons, rainbow flags, lots of happiness.
And so when will you actually marry?
We will hopefully get married today. Gina and I will, after we apply for the marriage license, we'll go to the probate court and ask for a waiver. And hopefully we'll get the whole thing taken care of today so that we can have a private ceremony tonight at home.
And why do you have to go to probate court?
That would be to apply for a waiver because there's normally a 3-day waiting period in Massachusetts after you apply for the license.
So this has been a number of years since you first filed suit. Tell us about that suit and your decision at the time. Did you ever think you'd get to this point?
We did. We thought that eventually we would get to this point, and we're very hopeful about that, but at the same time, it's a moment that just defied any kind of prediction. So it's both predicted and very wonderful for us.
Can you put Gina on the line?
I can. Here she is.
Good morning.
Gina, welcome to Democracy Now! Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us what made you decide to file suit several years ago that has led to this day for so many people in Massachusetts?
Oh, definitely. When we were preparing for the birth of our first child, Avery, who's now 7, we went to see a lawyer and prepared wills and documents and powers of attorneys and things. And then we got to a point where our lawyer couldn't help us anymore. We couldn't protect our family. And then while we were preparing for the birth of our second son, Quinn, who's 4, we got connected with Glenn because they were contemplating doing something about the situation.
And so you filed suit.
And so we filed suit, right.
Are there other people there with you who filed suit?
No, we are the only ones from this part of the state who were part of the suit.
How did you get ready this morning to go to get your marriage license?
Oh, we had to get up pretty early and encourage our boys to get up early and finish their oatmeal so they could get dressed. It's been pretty exciting this morning.
How old are your boys?
Avery is 7 and Quinn is 4.
Are they with you?
Yes, they are. And they're in their cute little suits with their yellow rose boutonnieres. They're very happy.
Could I speak with your 7-year-old?
Sure, sure. Hey, Avery, come here. And say hello. You're talking to Amy.
Hello.
Hi, Avery. How are you?
Good.
What are you feeling today?
Very, very happy and excited.
Can you tell us what it looks like?
Well, there are a lot of people, and we're seeing some people that we know, and we're very excited.
So your mothers are going to be married today?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
What?
What does that mean to you?
It means that they're going to get to be together for a very long time and that they'll always love each other.
Well, Avery, thanks very much for being with us on Democracy Now! And congratulations.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that is the Gina Smith and Heidi Norton family speaking to us from Northampton at Northampton's City Hall, where they are online to get a marriage license today. Tonight, they hope to be married in a quiet ceremony at home. This is Democracy Now! So Much Trouble in the World, Bob Marley, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The first of 7 Army reservists facing court-martial for the prisoner abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib prison goes on trial Wednesday in Baghdad. All 7 are saying they were following orders from superiors. How high do those orders go? Well, this weekend, the New Yorker broke another story with their Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Seymour Hersh. It's called The Gray Zone. Seymour Hersh begins, "The roots of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal lie not in the criminal inclinations of a few Army reservists, but in a decision approved last year by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to expand a highly secret operation which had been focused on the hunt for al-Qaeda to the interrogation of prisoners in Iraq. Rumsfeld's decision embittered the American intelligence community, damaged the effectiveness of elite combat units, and hurt America's prospects in the war on terror." Hersh goes on, "According to interviews with several past and present American intelligence officials, the Pentagon's operation, known inside the intelligence community by several code words, including copper green, encourage physical coercion and sexual humiliation of Iraqi prisoners in an effort to generate more intelligence about the growing insurgency in Iraq. a senior CIA official, in confirming the details of the account last week, said that the operation stemmed from Rumsfeld's long-standing desire to wrest control of America's clandestine and paramilitary operations from the CIA. I reached Seymour Hersh last night and asked him to talk about how a secret Pentagon program came to Abu Ghraib.
I guess you can't really tell that until you tell the story. I mean, this is a program that was initiated. This is a specially sort of compartmented, very deep sort of covert black operation that was initiated a few months after Afghanistan, essentially because once the major skirmishing in Afghan, you know, once the Taliban folded, we were left with still a war on terror, and the Pentagon was getting all kinds of leads and information, and they would want to send a special forces team, let's say, you know, name a country, Yemen, Sudan, to go pick up somebody, and there would be all this normal sort of process that happens in the American government. The American ambassador would want to know what's going on. The local military guys would want to know what's going on. The local government would want to know what's going on. Rumsfeld found it very easy. All of this stuff is not the way he likes to operate. He's very much cutting through all the bureaucracy. So he simply set up a back-channel operation. It was what they call a SAP, Special Access Program, a very highly classified program inside the Pentagon. And he recruited a bunch of Delta Force and SEALs and some CIA people and other services. I'm sure everybody was handpicked. Everybody in it was under an alias, under a cover, probably, I can't imagine, maybe foreign, I just don't know, and they didn't need visas. They had the SAP, the Special Access Program, had a budget. They were buying covert planes, and by that I mean planes that were not described as discovered, marked as American, necessarily, certainly not as a military plane, and all the apparatus you need to run a secret little war, and they would pick up people, and they had their own detention centers, and apparently they would get the first cut of Al Qaeda or suspected terrorists, and really the ones that weren't so useful went to Guantanamo. Pretty interesting. So, and then this group has been operating; it's been going on for a year and a half, 2 years now, I guess, close to it, and without any trouble. And last fall, because things were falling apart in Baghdad and Iraq pretty badly, much more than the public knew. We had the UN bombing, the Jordanian bombing, but also internally there was a lot of anxiety about what was going on with the insurgency. Nobody knew anything. We had no sources. And it was decided in August, September that it's time to really get inside the Iraqi prison population, although we all understand that the prison population in Iraq is a lot different than, let's say, in Guantanamo, because take your pick, General Antonio Taguba report, the one that was out, made so much noise a few weeks ago. Taguba said 60% of the people in prison were basically innocents. The International Red Cross says 90%. So you had a situation where you had a different pool. Nonetheless, this special team was brought in at Rumsfeld and his deputy for intelligence request, a guy named Stephen Cambone, brought it into Baghdad over the objections of everybody in the community. I shouldn't say everybody, many people, obviously, because you don't take a very quiet, clandestine program and move it into a military situation, into a war, because it doesn't function that way. And you dilute its value. In any case, they went into the prison. Very, very tough orders were given. We're going to use coercion if we have to, and we're also going to use sexual blackmail. We're going to get these Ba'athist Sunnis. Rumsfeld was calling them by that time last fall the dead-enders. These are the Ba'athist Sunnis, supporters of Saddam, that we thought were the core of the insurgency that we could not find. So the goal was to go into the prison population, get these guys, if we have to blackmail them by putting them in a compromising sexual position, do it. We all have gone through the ritual, Amy, of how terrifyingly of a taboo it is in Islamic society for men to appear naked before other men, really. And we were going to do that, threaten to take the photographs of them and distribute it in their neighborhood to their family, to their mothers and fathers and wives or whatever. Totally embarrassing them. And I think the goal was to, A, try and get some people to tell us what they knew, and B, try and convince some people to go leave the prison and go back into the Sunni community and spy. But whatever it was, it quickly got out of control. By late October, I've been told, the CIA had some people involved in this program. They pulled out. They pulled out all of their people involved in the interrogation process in Abu Ghraib. Their general counsel said, this is nuts. They pulled out, and the program, you know, went along out of control, basically, until it started getting in trouble early this year.
And how do you know that Donald Rumsfeld himself knew?
Well, I don't have a videotape, but I can tell you that these programs, these special access programs, these SAP programs, I have learned a great deal about them. They can only be set up with the Secretary of Defense's approval. And the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chief, they're all involved in the setting up this. So he certainly was there at the beginning. And I'm told, the people that talked to me, I'm told that whatever Cambone did was cleared with, he wasn't able to make a move like this without getting it cleared with Rumsfeld. So Rumsfeld had, Amy, nobody's suggesting that Rumsfeld knew the kind of wackiness that was going on. That isn't the point. The point is that the core, the soul of what happened was the decision that was made. The genesis of the problems was in a decision that was made at Rumsfeld's level to bring this very secret, effective team into Baghdad. And not all of it, some remnants of it. And also, my understanding is some of the people in military intelligence at the time were read into the program, this program that had been restricted so carefully.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, won the Pulitzer Prize for his reports. The Pentagon has issued a statement on Hersh's New Yorker piece, calling his claims outlandish, conspiratorial, and filled with error and anonymous conjecture. We'll come back with Seymour Hersh in a minute.
I heard terrorism makes good television. It's no coincidence, and as a matter of fact, if it weren't guaranteed to be on television, there'd be less reason for a terrorist attack. I heard television loves an enemy. It's no conspiracy, but it's still crass. It's cheer the home team and it's exile the underdog. And it's feel fantastic after kicking someone's ass.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, another expose in The New Yorker magazine. In the piece, you talk about Stephen Cambone as well as his aide, Army Lieutenant General William Boykin, the evangelical Christian who often discusses the war on terror in terms of a holy war. Once, while he was discussing a battle in Somalia against a Muslim warlord, Boykin told a crowd, "I knew my God was bigger than his. I knew my God was a real God and that his was an idol." He told another audience, "The enemy in the war on terror is a guy named Satan." And at least once he said of President Bush, "He's in the White House because God put him there." What's the connection to Cambone, and did he have anything to do with it?
Well, he's Cambone's military deputy, his military aide in the Office of Intelligence, and we know he made at least one trip to visit Jeffrey, so I'm told, and so it's been reported. He made one trip to visit the other part of this that's sort of interesting that we don't know. I don't know all the pieces of the commandant of the prison at Guantanamo, Major General Jeffrey Miller, was also brought up to Baghdad at this time in the fall of 2003, and also recommended very tough stuff. And there definitely is. I've heard this. I didn't write this because I've only heard it from one person. And it's more anecdotal, but I heard that he was the liaison, and frankly, in testimony, Cambone suggested as much, that his liaison to some of these, to Miller, anyway, at Guantanamo, would have been Boykin. Boykin would have been in the middle of this. Although, I have to tell you, in the Pentagon, Cambone's held in very low repute by professional intelligence people because he's seen as sort of, not only sort of a lackey for Rumsfeld, but also somebody who doesn't know what he doesn't know, which is very dangerous, and he's not very experienced in intelligence. And many of the people in the community are much more comfortable with Boykin because he served in Delta Force, and for all of his problems he caused for the government by comparing Muslims to Satan, he knows, he understands intelligence much more than Cambone.
What about this man, Kenneth DeGraffenreid? What was his role?
No, DeGraffenreid was a high-level civilian intelligence officer. He's an expert on counterintelligence. And before Cambone came on, the office Cambone has, the Undersecretary for Intelligence, is the new office voted by Congress, I think very much at Rumsfeld's request, because Rumsfeld has been in the struggle with the CIA and the other intelligence. He's been trying to take over intelligence. Certainly he wants to take over the covert warfare, the idea of being able to operate overseas. And I think one thing he did with this special activity he did was sort of bureaucratically ace out CIA. And the DeGraffenreid's job before this new office was created was sort of the point man on the SAP program. There are a lot of special activities programs. Most of them have to do, the SAPs we call them, most of them have to do with very secret procurement issues. For example, the stealth bomber was a SAP. They funded all the work on the stealth through this secret program to protect the secret, this Predator, the unmanned aircraft, and its ability to fire missiles was all done in a SAP. I think my guess is it's unusual to run a covert operation, but I don't know that. And the DeGraffenreid was sort of a bureaucratic loser when Cambone came in, because Cambone muscled out the DeGraffenreid for control over the SAPs.
You've been talking about the SAP, the Special Access Program. What about President Bush? What's the involvement of the Oval Office in this?
Well, nobody, one thing that is known is that this program, this secret program in Afghanistan that was set up to cut through the bureaucracy, was certainly cleared with the president. Beyond that, I just don't know.
Newsweek is reporting that Bush knew and signed off on this, that there was a meeting in the Oval Office, that there was a memo. What is your comment on this?
Well, I heard about the story today. I haven't read it. It could be the same program. It could not be. I think this program was a very sensitive special access. Is really sort of, in other words, there could have been more than one operation going on. The CIA was doing some interrogations on its own, at its own facilities. This special activity, the special access group, was so dark and so deep in the sense that nobody really knew what they were doing. I'm not sure they're the same program, but if they are, I just don't know. The answer is I don't know.
What about Major General Jeffrey Miller? You talk about the significance of the commander of the Detention Interrogation Center at Guantanamo coming to Baghdad and what this meant, his review in late August, and how this tied to the changes in policy at Abu Ghraib.
Well, late August, as I said, was a terrible time after the UN, blowing up of the UN and the killing of D'Amelio, the UN rep there. Was a very bad time. Also, you have to again remember that the insurgency was showing incredible sophistication, and our intelligence people realized that we knew very little about it. And so Miller was there. It's silly for me to speculate, but clearly the Miller visit, the events in the fall, and the shifting of this new unit, the secret unit, is some of its people with this very tough go, package into Baghdad, into Abu Ghraib, among other prisons. They're very closely related. I mean, what the timeline is, I'm not sure, but I would guess that we're talking about Miller's visit, the crisis, and the new involvement of the SAP program. We're talking, a few weeks. All these decisions were made in the late summer, early fall of last year.
We're talking to investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. What about Major General Taguba, the one who did this explosive report on the prison abuse? What did he understand? Did he know anything about this SAP program?
No. My friends say no.
Then why did they let him do this report?
Well, I can't answer the question. I don't know why they did or didn't do anything, but I can just tell you that one of the thoughts was, the people I talked with about this program, one of the thoughts was, when in January, this young man, the young military policeman who couldn't believe what he saw in those videos, turned in the CD with all the photos to the Army. At that point, the chronology is very interesting because if you think about it, what the Pentagon has said is that on the 16th, Rumsfeld was briefed. Rumsfeld also said many times in his testimony that there are 18,000 court-martials a year. Here's an investigation, and he's briefed on the 16th, 2.5 days later, and he goes to the president right away. That's very interesting to me. But again, that's just interesting to me. I don't have any facts about it, but it suggests, you know, a sensitivity. Given all the court-martials he says there are, well, how could he pay attention to one? But one of the thoughts was, again, so I'm told, is that you can't stop this investigation. That would be too clumsy because the Army Criminal Investigation Division is very sort of a clean group. I mean, there's a bunch of enlisted men who love to get generals, and they were into it. What you do is just control it. You just let some people, the idea was to let a few kids, you know, let the people below get hung and contain it. And as part of that, they had to do an investigation. And Taguba did an investigation. I just think he stunned everybody by doing such a good one. I did notice that in this Senate testimony the other week with Cambone, he backtracked on many of the things he'd written. And so I assume they took him to the woodshed.
What about what Rumsfeld and Cambone said at the Senate hearing? How careful was Rumsfeld in talking about these issues, and what about the SAP that he raised at the hearing?
Oh, well, he didn't. Of course, under the law, he can't mention something that secret. It was an unclassified. He could have made it clear that he wanted to go, you know, into a classified session, and he could have said something to the effect that there was more there. The fact of the matter is, I don't have a sense. I understand there was a classified session during this time, but I don't have a sense that any of the senators were told about the SAP. And under the rules of that program, those special access programs, only a few are actually briefed. Most of the procurement ones are briefed to the Congress, but the more sensitive ones are not. They're just given some budget ideas and some vague descriptions. They're not fully briefed. And so it's unlikely he talked about it, but if there was a classified session. But in the public session, certainly he made it seem as if he was being, there was an open apology, and it made it seem as if he was really in as much of a quandary as the rest of us were about how such awful things happen. And so that seems to me that the next step should be, and what I've been saying is that the next step is sort of up to the senators to see if they want to sort of, this has been, I think we can charitably describe it as a very supine Congress. And maybe it's time for them to do something.
In your piece in The New Yorker, you talk about some surprise visits of the JAG, the Judge Advocate General lawyers, the military lawyers, to the chair of the New York City Bar Association's Committee on International Human Rights.
Well, yes. At least twice, the man's name is Horton. He's as you say, he works for the Bar Association. He's been involved in these issues for many years on legal issues, Geneva Convention, and he was visited twice. I think there's no question that the Judge Advocate Corps of the Armed Services are very upset. Kenneth Roth, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, has had visits. It seems clear that the lawyers of the Pentagon feel that there are programs being devised sort of behind their back and that they have not much power to do much. And so we've really had a significant change here in this country in terms of respect for the Geneva Convention in its administration.
I want to thank you very much, Seymour Hersh, investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His piece this week in The New Yorker magazine is called The Gray Zone, How a Secret Pentagon Program Came to Abu Ghraib. And you are listening to Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. As we turn now to Halliburton. Hundreds of pig-snouted activists will be out in front of the glamorous Four Seasons Hotel in downtown Houston Wednesday to protest the annual shareholders' meeting of Halliburton, what they call bringing home the Halibacon. Halliburton is the largest oil and gas services company in the world. It's also one of the most controversial corporations in the United States. The company has been the number one financial beneficiary of the invasion of Iraq, raking in some $18 billion in contracts to rebuild Iraq's oil industry and service U.S. troops. It's also been accused of more fraud, waste, and corruption than any other Iraq contractor, with allegations ranging from overcharging tens of millions of dollars for fuel and meals to outright bribery. Halliburton's also currently under investigation by the Department of Justice. And of course, the connections to the Bush administration cannot run deeper. Vice President Dick Cheney is the former chief executive of Halliburton prior to his taking office in 2000. Today, we'll take an in-depth look at Halliburton with the author of a new book, The Halliburton Agenda, Dan Briody. First, we will go to Houston with Prothap Chatterjee, who's managing director of CorpWatch.org. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Prothap.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us about the preparations as well as the new report that CorpWatch has out called Houston, We Have a Problem?
Indeed, Amy. Houston, we do have a problem, and the problem is Halliburton and its relationship with the U.S. government and especially with the military in Iraq. But actually, as you mentioned, a much longer-standing problem, which is that of global warming and dealing with corrupt dictatorships around the world. Halliburton's been around for 80 years, and for much of the last, certainly in the last decade, they've been dealing with governments from Iran to Azerbaijan, countries that, in fact, that we've often had rules against doing business with, and they have deliberately gone and worked with these people in order to make a profit. And actually, the back cover of the report has a quote from Dick Cheney where he says, "The problem is that the good Lord didn't see fit to put oil and gas reserves where there are democratically elected regimes friendly to the interests of the United States." And this is really the story of a company that has, you know, over a period of years, and Dan can probably speak this more eloquently than I can, started out by stealing technology. Oil well technology, Mr. Earl Halliburton stole it from his former boss and then made a huge profit in selling this around the world. And now they're making a profit out of doing this in war zones directly by supporting the U.S. military and by using sweatshop labor from India. We've just heard in the last week or so that people have been paying snakeheads in India in order to get jobs in Iraq. And then once they come, they get to Iraq, they're held as virtual slaves. So what CorpWatch is doing here in Houston is we've issued this report, Houston, We Have a Problem. The cover is actually a picture of the oil fires and the oil wells down in southern Iraq that I took with David Martinez back in December. And this report, which is issued in conjunction with Global Exchange and also in collaboration with the Center for Corporate Policy, Common Cause, the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, the Institute for Southern Studies and Taxpayers for Common Sense, we're going to make this available to shareholders on Wednesday so that they can see what really is happening. It's a beautiful report, and actually it goes very well along with Halliburton's own stated policy today. For some reason, their new sort of logo seems to be Think Red. So we brought them a red report, and we're going to be telling people here exactly what's happening. And as you mentioned, Amy, I believe there will be 200 pig-snouted executives waiting outside the Four Seasons Hotel on Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock. And indeed, many of them will be in attendance at a place called The Station on Tuesday night, where there's going to be an event, a teach-in, to talk about what's happening. And that's at 1502 Alabama, in 1502 Alabama, I think it is, in Houston.
You talk about the former Halliburton employee who blew the whistle on overspending.
Henry Bunting is one of many people, in fact, several of whom I've talked to, other of whom we hear may come forward in the next week or so, to explain that Halliburton has deliberately, overcharged the government and knew and has falsified information in order to be able to make a profit. For example, Amy, the military requires Halliburton or any contractor, indeed, to competitively bid something that's priced over $2,500 in order to make sure that people aren't sole sourcing materials and buying it from their friends. Well, Halliburton's done exactly the opposite of what the military doctrine requires, which is if they wanted to buy a camera that was worth $5,000, they split it into two task orders, and they said, today we'll buy half the camera, tomorrow we'll buy the other half the camera. And they asked the vendor to provide them with two invoices. Now, that's illegal. And the reason is we're expecting them to be able to get us the best price. And what Henry Bunting proved was, and he was part of this, and then he left because he's so disgusted with their methods, was they were going out there buying things without asking people for prices. And they were purchasing supplies that were three times the actual cost of what they needed to pay. For example, they bought these orange embroidered towels, which said MWR, the logo of an army unit. I think it's Morale, Welfare, and Recreation. Rather than buying just regular towels, which they could have gotten for $1.50, they paid three times as much. And we understand that there may be more people coming forward next week or so to explain how Halliburton has deliberately falsified or asked its employees to deliberately falsify the logs so that they can charge more for the transportation of materials across Iraq and hand us the bill.
Prathap Chatterjee, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Houston, where the shareholders' meeting will be taking place of Halliburton on Wednesday with major protests outside. Author of Corp Watch's Houston, We Have a Problem report on Halliburton. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Dan Briody joins us of the Halliburton Agenda. Also tonight, I'm looking forward to seeing folks in Albany, a benefit for WRPI, at the Livingston Magnet Academy at 315 Northern Boulevard, and on Wednesday night at the Jacob Burns Center in Westchester, New York, in Pleasantville, New York. We'll be screening independent media in a time of war, and the revolution will not be televised. I'll be speaking as well. And our continuation of the Exception to the Rulers tour, and you can see more at democracynow.org. Stay with us.
I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, be it olives, safflower, crude. For cooking, for cars, take a rocket to the stars, for a back rub, romantic rendezvous. In your engine, on your face, or almost any place, a little dab of oil will get you through. Oh, I'd go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate the red, white, and blue. If you drive a big V8, it's time to celebrate, they're gonna fight a war for you. To keep gas prices cheap, so when you drive or when you sleep, you can do it in an air-conditioned room. For driving is your right, so let's get out there and fight. You can read that in the Constitution. Shouldn't I go anywhere to fight for oil, to lubricate that red, white, and blue? Here we go now. I'd go anywhere to fight for oil.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Halliburton Agenda, the Politics of Oil and Money. It's Dan Briody's new book. Dan Briody, who wrote the best-selling book, The Iron Triangle, which was inside the secret world of the Carlyle Group. Why did you decide to focus on Halliburton?
Well, it seemed like a natural extension of what I had already reported on with the Iron Triangle, which was essentially this idea of the military-industrial complex, you know, the confluence of big business, the defense industry, and politicians. So Halliburton, like the Carlyle Group, is a company that uses political influence in order to enhance its finances. And that's essentially its modus operandi. It's how it does business. And certainly with everything that's going on in Iraq right now, the incredible amount of money that Halliburton has garnered in contracts. Some people put it at $9 billion, some people put it at more. It was definitely a subject worth looking at right now.
Tell us who Halliburton was. Who is this company named after? A thumbnail sketch of Halliburton and its subsidiary, KBR.
You know, it's funny. Both of the companies have been around since 1919. They were both started in Texas. And Halliburton itself is essentially a very unromantic oil field services company. Earl Halliburton, the namesake of the company, was a guy who was hardworking. He intensely disliked politics, kept his company out of politics as much as possible. It's the KBR subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, which until recently was just called Brown & Root, which was highly, highly political throughout its history. Herman and George Brown, the brothers in Texas, had a very close relationship with Lyndon Johnson. They contributed heavily to his campaigns and in return got very, very lucrative government contracts.
Can you talk about the relationship between the Browns and Lyndon Johnson, which does seem to be a model for what's happening today?
It is, and I think that the idea that politicians could build this company began even before that, when Brown and Root started getting local road building contracts in their county in Texas. But they sort of grew up when they met Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson became a congressman from the 10th District in Texas, and they began contributing to his campaigns. And in return, Lyndon Johnson really worked for these guys on Capitol Hill. He literally would push through task orders and change orders for contracts that they were working on to get more public funding for big dam projects, and then push them towards Navy shipbuilding during World War II, got them contracts to build air bases, naval air bases, Corpus Christi, all the way up until the Johnson presidency when he was working for them to get space contracts. These guys built the Houston Space Center and also some strange contracts for the National Science Foundation. It goes on and on.
And what did Johnson get in return?
Johnson got a phenomenal amount of financial backing for his campaigns. Much of it was illegal contributions. If you've read any of the Robert Caro biographies of Lyndon Johnson, you have a good idea of how business was done back then. The Brown brothers were incredible contributors to Lyndon Johnson's campaigns, bags of cash being passed around, hundreds of thousands of dollars, funding campaigns the likes of which Texas, the nation, had never seen at that time. And a lot of this came under investigation by the IRS and things of that nature, but many of the investigations were scuttled, and Brown and Root got away with a slap on the wrist.
Interesting, going well back to the time of Lyndon Johnson and the deal he had with the Brown brothers, the way they helped each other, to put it nicely. You have people in the government saying these are no bid contracts with a company, Brown & Root, who has no experience doing the things, for example, building of the dam or the Corpus Christi base. So how'd they get away with it?
Yeah, so it's a testament to the power of political influence that these contracts would even be given to a company like Brown & Root. Brown & Root was literally a road builder. All they knew was how to grade and pave roads until this Mansfield Dam project comes along. They decide they want it. Lyndon Johnson decides it would be a good political move to give it to them and sort of create this relationship between this high-powered company. Away they went. And this is a company that has never turned down work, no matter how strange or different it is from their core competency. And in fact, if you look at the company today, you know, Halliburton is an oil field services company. KBR is essentially an arm of the military. The two should have very little to do with each other, but as we both know, that's not the case today.
We're talking with Dan Briody. He is author of a new book, The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money. And Dan, today, compare what we saw with KBR or BR, Brown and Root, then, with what's happening in Iraq today, how they get these deals.
Well, it's very similar, obviously. The company still believes in the power of political influence. Otherwise, why hire Dick Cheney as your CEO in 1995, a man who had absolutely no business experience whatsoever? He was a career politician. There seemed to be no reason to hire him. But if you look at what took place between 95 and 2000 while Dick Cheney was CEO, it's very clear why they hired him. He had a tenfold increase in the amount of loans that Halliburton was given by the U.S. Export-Import Bank. He shot them up the list of the Pentagon's top contractors. On and on, the sort of government contracting business just grew wildly during Dick Cheney's tenure there. And so I think it's very obvious that Halliburton has a legacy of a very political business that continues today.
You quote Dick Cheney saying the biggest problem that he faced as Secretary of Defense was the Congress, and the biggest problem he faced as CEO of Halliburton was the Congress.
Right. And this is a man who has said publicly that his success at Halliburton and his financial success, which I think comes in at around $30 million, that was his severance package when he left the company, had nothing to do with the United States government, which is laughable when you look at the type of business that these guys are in and why Dick Cheney was brought on board. So, you know, a quote like that, my biggest problem as CEO of Halliburton is the United States Congress, just sort of gives you an idea of just how political this business is. I mean, it is all about buying and selling of politicians.
Talk about how KBR came to be a subsidiary, or Brown & Root came to be a subsidiary, but more importantly, the role Dick Cheney played with what LogCap is.
Right. So as I said before, Halliburton was essentially an oilfield services company, and Brown & Root was this very political animal from the start. In 1962, Halliburton acquired KBR, which was at that point Brown & Root. And so since then, the nature of Halliburton's business has become increasingly political. And in fact, the company has used Brown & Root as a stalking horse for business overseas and things of that nature. So, but it wasn't until 1992 when Halliburton and KBR got a contract called LogCap, which is the Logistical Civil Augmentation Program. Essentially, it's the outsourcing of all of the logistics for the U.S. Army. The Navy and the Marines have similar contracts, both of which are owned by KBR as well. So this is a contract that the company actually designed themselves. They were contracted by the Pentagon to design the contract, and then were allowed to bid on that very same contract, obviously giving them a pretty decided advantage in winning it, considering the fact that they had already created it. That contract is usually for 5 years at a time and can be fantastically lucrative. It is right now, as I said, approaching $9 billion for the work in Iraq. It is essentially made KBR another branch of the United States military, which is absolutely critical to their operations today.
What about the privatization of the military? We hear very little about that.
So this is something that makes KBR's business tick, the outsourcing or privatization of the military. You know, when the Cold War ended, there was going to be the supposed peacetime dividend, and the troop forces were reduced and the amount of defense spending was reduced. Now, the way that the Army got around that was by outsourcing a lot of the critical functions, including some of the sort of lower profile functions like building camps, cleaning the latrines, doing the laundry, serving the food. Anything that was not a direct military operation was outsourced, and KBR was the recipient of that work. Now, the dangers of that are obviously that these folks are not answering within the chain of command in the military. They can leave if they feel that their life is threatened. And if they don't perform their duties or if they're overcharging, they're not subject to court martials the way that military personnel are.
What about Halliburton's record of business in Libya, Iran, Iraq?
Yeah, you know, Prothap mentioned this earlier, but I think what's stunning to me, yes, there is a history of doing business in countries that are under government sanctions right now or UN sanctions, and I think that the most eye-popping example is the business that the company did in Iraq between 1995 and 2000 while Dick Cheney was CEO. Just as a reminder, this is, of course, between wars that Dick Cheney led against Iraq, once as Secretary of Defense and now as Vice President. His company was doing millions and millions of dollars of business with Saddam Hussein through the Oil for Food program that the UN was running. This was a program that was widely considered to be a joke and very much abused on both sides. And Halliburton acquired a company called Dresser that was doing a good amount of business in Iraq during that time. It just sort of shows that Dick Cheney has these sort of politics of convenience. As Secretary of Defense, Saddam is an evil, brutal dictator. But as CEO of Halliburton, he's a good person to do business with.
We're talking with Dan Briody about Halliburton Corporation, the site of a lot of protests this week, Houston shareholders meeting. A lot of people will be outside, many charging that Halliburton is making a killing off the killing in Iraq. What about overcharging?
Well, this is something that has dogged this company since its very beginnings. Like I said, they have worked in World War II, Vietnam, Bosnia, Somalia. And what often happens is that in the sort of fog of war, the military is not that interested in how much things are costing them. They don't have time to audit every task order that comes their way. They're more interested in speed. And in the past, KBR has been very, very good at that. And that's why the military loves them, because they get them things, they make their lives better over there. On the flip side, the contracts that are awarded to this company are called cost plus, which essentially means that KBR is covered for all of their costs for whatever they pay for to provide the military, plus a guaranteed profit on top of that. Now, what a contract like this does, obviously, is encourages the contractor to overspend. The more they spend, the higher their profit is going to be. And also, the more they spend, the happier the military is, because it's not their money and their lives are better. So they'll give them good marks, which actually improves their profit margins. So, when you start looking at contracts that are in the area of $9 billion, 1-5% on top of that is a good chunk of change.
It's amazing when you read the history of Halliburton, how this worked going way back when they were trying to figure out the amount they would charge, say, for a dam or for a base, being told it doesn't matter. You can undercharge, because once you've got this contract,
right,
the government is completely dependent on you. And then it doesn't matter how much you say you are experiencing in cost overruns. They're going to have to pay it.
Exactly. You get your foot in the door. You get established as the primary contractor for a job, and there's virtually no way that you can be pulled off that job. And I don't think that there's any better example of that than what KBR is doing with the LogCAP contract right now. In fact, if you look back in 1995, when they took over in Bosnia and started doing the work there, a new contractor was supposed to take over that work in 1997, but the military found it literally impossible to get KBR out of Bosnia. They were so intimately involved in every detail of that operation that they were indispensable, and they couldn't leave.
Dick Cheney's relationship with Halliburton today.
Today, he is still in contact with the executives. They sort of look at him actually as like a godfather figure. They have a ton of respect for him, which is a little confounding from my perspective, because his track record at the company is awful.
But the money he is making.
Oh, he's still making a deferred salary payment, an annual payment of about $150,000 a year. I think he made $178,000 this year. So he is still on the Halliburton payroll.
The Vice President of the United States.
Correct.
Still on the Halliburton payroll, that is making the most money of any corporation in Iraq.
That's correct.
I want to thank you for being with us. Dan Briody, The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money is the title of his new book. And that does it for today's program. You can go to our website for contact information at democracynow.org. Again, look forward to seeing folks tonight in Albany, New York. At the Livingston Magnet Academy, 315 Northern Boulevard at 7 o'clock, celebrating WRPI and Hudson Mohawk Indie Media on Wednesday at the Jacob Burns Center in Pleasantville, New York. That's Wednesday, May 19th, starting at 5:15 right through 9 o'clock in the evening. I'll be there as we show The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, an independent media in a time of war, and talking about the exception to the rulers. Democracy Now! Is produced by Shroof Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Now!
Keeps raining.